From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been almost 3 years since a freak stage accident left Curtis Mayfield paralyzed from the neck down. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the great soul singer and songwriter and listen to some of his records from the 60s and 70s, like People Get Ready, Keep On Pushing, We're a Winner, and Freddy's Dead. Also today, economic espionage. Some of our allies are spying on American businesses, stealing trade secrets. The American intelligence community is debating whether we should start spying on foreign business. We'll talk with Peter Schweitzer, author of the new book, Friendly Spies. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Tribeca, the new drama series premiering on Fox. Robert De Niro is one of the producers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The leader of Russia's parliament called today for the impeachment of President Boris Yeltsin. The call came after Russia's high court found that Yeltsin had acted unconstitutionally when he declared emergency rule several days ago. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Ruslan Hasbulatov, the Speaker of the Russian Parliament, intensified his attack on President Yeltsin today, declaring that the grounds for impeachment are now as clear as day. Earlier, the Russian Constitutional Court found that in his declaration of presidential rule, Yeltsin violated 8 articles of the Russian Constitution, but the court stopped short of declaring that Yeltsin should be impeached. Hasbulatov convened the Russian Parliament in order to call for a session of the larger legislature, the Congress of People's Deputies, which is the only body that is empowered to impeach the president. But many deputies were not eager to proceed as quickly as Hasbulatov, and the parliament adjourned without taking any action. Tomorrow, the parliament is expected to convene a session of the Congress, but there is now significant doubt that Yeltsin's opponents can muster the necessary 2/3 majority to remove him from office. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
President Clinton expressed strong support for President Yeltsin in his news conference today, but he also left open the possibility that the United States might back other reformers. The president said that U.S. interests in Russia include limitation of nuclear weapons, the development of democracy, and movement toward a free market economy. He said those would remain American interests with or without President Yeltsin in authority. In any event, President Clinton told reporters that he'll be ready with an aggressive and quite specific plan of aid for Yeltsin's government at next week's summit meeting. The president also talked more at his news conference today about the process of filling the upcoming vacancy on the Supreme Court. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
President Clinton said that while he would seek to appoint a justice who supports abortion rights, he would not ask any potential nominee how he or she would vote in an abortion case.
But I will endeavor to appoint someone who has certain deep convictions about the Constitution. I would not, for example, knowingly appoint someone that did not have a very strong view about the First Amendment's freedom of religion, freedom of association, and freedom of speech provisions. And I strongly believe in the constitutional right to privacy. I believe it is one of those rights embedded in our Constitution, which should be protected.
Asked whether he would seek to appoint women and minorities to the nation's highest court, Mr. Clinton clearly avoided making any pledges of diversity, pledges that he made often and eagerly about the selection of his cabinet. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. Analysts said investors were cautious about the turmoil in Russia, fearing that it could drain away the so-called peace dividend and ruin hopes for cutting the deficit. The Dow lost about 1.5 points to close at 3,462. This is NPR. The European Community's mediator at the Bosnian peace talks said today that the Bosnian Serb delegation has withdrawn from this round of negotiations. Lord David Owen told reporters that Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has refused to agree to a key proposal to divide Bosnia into ethnically based provinces. Karadzic is also said to be angry that Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic has refused to meet with him. Owen said it's clear that Karadzic still wants an independent Serbian state in Bosnian territory. Millions of air travelers will receive discount coupons for airline tickets following the settlement of an antitrust lawsuit against 9 airlines. The air carriers were accused of collusion in setting ticket prices. Ed Hula has more from Atlanta.
The settlement agreed to by an Atlanta federal judge and the airline industry is worth about $456 million. Nearly anyone who flew on American, Continental, Delta, Midway, Pan Am, and US Air as well as TWA and Northwest from 1988 through June of last year, is eligible to apply for a portion of the settlement. The airlines admit no wrongdoing in settling the suit, which charges they conspired to set airfares. The president of Delta Airlines says the airline settled to avoid a long and expensive trial. Air travelers have until June 1st to file a claim with discount coupons to be mailed in 1994. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Hula in Atlanta.
Members of the Branch Davidian religious sect have displayed a new banner outside their compound near Waco, Texas. The banner says, "We want Ron Engelman," and apparently refers to a Dallas radio talk show host who's asked sect members to display messages. Since early in the 24-day standoff, authorities have refused to let sect leader David Koresh have direct access to the media. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Curtis Mayfield is one of the great singers and songwriters of soul music. In the 60s, with his group The Impressions, he had such hits as Gypsy Woman, People Get Ready, I'm So Proud, We're a Winner, and It's All Right. In the 70s, he did the soundtrack for Superfly. In 1990, he wrote some of the music for the sequel, The Return of Superfly. Later that year, he was the victim of a freak stage accident. He was performing at an outdoor concert before an audience of about 10,000 in Brooklyn, New York, when a lighting scaffold was blown over by a gust of wind and fell on Mayfield, breaking his neck, leaving him paralyzed from the neck down. As a tribute to him, Shawnee Records has just released a recording featuring Mayfield's songs performed by Jerry Butler, Delbert McClinton, Bunny Wailer, and others. Half of the royalties will go toward Mayfield's medical bills. Today we pay tribute to Curtis Mayfield with an interview and with some of his great records.
We're a winner, and never let anybody say, well, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, and we have finally dried our eyes, and we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, moving on up. We're living proof and all's alert that we're two from the good black girl. Tell you to. At last that blessed day has come, and I don't care where you come from. We're all moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, moving on up. Woo.
I asked Curtis Mayfield if he's been able to write songs since his accident.
No, I haven't been writing, to be honest. Since my injury, there's been no writings from Curtis. However, I hope that these things may change very soon, being that there are different computers and instruments that I'm about to get off into that may help me to relate my writings as well as my music through vocal contact and what have you.
Is there still a lot of music in your head?
Oh, yeah, I think so. With me, everything is a song. Probably even through our conversation, there may be a few ideas.
Do you have memories of the accident, or do you not remember what happened?
Well, my personal memories of the accident are quite faint, being as it did happen to me. I wasn't really around to observe too much.
What do you remember?
Being on the floor and waking up on the floor, paralyzed.
I'd like to talk with you, if you'd be willing, about your past and, you know, your music career. I know that when you were growing up, your grandmother had a church, the Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church. Did you hear her preach a lot?
Oh, yes. Reverend A.B. Mayfield, Annabelle Mayfield. And, of course, I heard her preach a lot. And I probably, even in my sleep, subconsciously observed a whole lot of her sermons. And I believe through herself and my mother, who was quite fond of all types of music and poems and things of that sort, she used to read to me a lot of the old Paul Laurence Dunbar writings and lyrics, and I was quite acquainted with the limericks and Dr. Seuss of the old years. And and of course, I identified with her teaching me a few things on the piano as a youngster. So through these two ladies, I believe over the years, I've carried out not only my ambitions, but theirs as well.
Now, did you sing in her church?
Yes, I did. As I became older, around 7, 8 years old, I became acquainted with my cousins, who was a part of the church, and they started a group known as the Northern Jubilees. And I believe this is what sort of laid out my fundamentals as to harmonies, because I can recall years ago our playing and my watching this black and white specialty record, which was 78 RPMs then, and listening to such artists as Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, the Five Blind Boys. And of course, you'd have to wind up this Victrola that we had and insert needles every so many records to keep, you know, to keep it going proper. And this is how I got started, I believe, with my harmonies.
What part did you sing in the group?
I was always a tenor.
When you started playing guitar and started writing songs, were they secular songs or gospel songs?
They were what I would think pop songs, you know. While I have written a few gospel songs, which would be looked upon as gospel, I call them more inspirational. Such songs as People Get Ready and Keep On Pushing. Keep On Pushing actually was written as a gospel song. However, I found that all I need to do was change one lyric or one word, and it was pop for us.
What, the word was God that you would change?
That's right. Instead of God gave me my strength, I said I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
Why don't we play the impressions, People Get Ready? And maybe before we hear it, you could tell us about how you wrote the song, when you wrote it. What was going through your mind then?
Well, I can't really recall when I wrote this particular song, but this is a perfect example of what I believe has laid in my subconscious as to the preachings of my grandmother and most ministers when they reflect from the Bible. You know, people get ready, there's a train coming, there's no hiding place, you don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
Why don't we hear it? This is Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to Jordan, coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and board 'em. There's hope for all among those loved the most.
Curtis Mayfield is joining us from his home in Georgia. You became the lead singer of the Impressions after Jerry Butler left. And the first hit that you had with you as lead singer was Gypsy Woman. This was, I think, 1961. So you wrote the song, you sang lead. It's a great record. It's funny. The lyric is about something that I'm sure you had absolutely no firsthand knowledge of. You know, a gypsy woman who, you know, all through the caravan, she was dancing with all the men. I mean, did you know any gypsy women when you wrote this?
No. And that's absolutely true. But I saw lots of Western movies.
Oh, right. I'm sure I saw the same ones.
Yes. And it's funny, 20, 25 years later, I'm in Germany, and I'm performing in concert, and I'm hearing people, you know, calling for Gypsy Woman, which was in the repertoire, but I hadn't come to it yet. And after the show, I had an interview, such as what we're doing now, and the interviewer spoke in terms of there being lots of gypsies in the place, which was out of the ordinary. Gypsies never came to concerts. And, of course, they asked me about it, and I had no idea other than maybe the song. They liked the song. Well, after the interview, across the street, I'd been invited to a restaurant where there was about 50 to 75 gypsies. All the men sitting in a circle and their women in the middle. And when I walked in the place, they gave me a standing ovation, great applause. And one of the gentlemen came up to shake my hand and they say, "Curtis, we've been waiting for you for 20 years.
My guest is soul music star Curtis Mayfield. A freak stage accident in 1990 left him paralyzed from the neck down. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Curtis Mayfield is joining us from his home in Georgia. You were one of the first, pop songwriters to write songs that became, well, Black Pride anthems, songs like "Keep on Pushing," "I'm So Proud," "We're a Winner." Did you have any awakenings in that area? You know, was there a period when you became more involved with, you know, the Black consciousness movement? Or more?
Well, through my own ways, more so through my songs.
Mm-hmm.
However, through my songs, I became acquainted and met many people, such as Andrew Young and the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and our mayor here, Mayor Jackson, and others. They were young men, and we were the youngsters coming up under them. And through many of our songs, and with the help of so many fans who were just people, we were involved.
Curtis Mayfield is my guest. He's joining us from his home in Georgia. Did you have any problems handling success as a young man?
No, I've always been, if you may allow me say, quite calm, cool, and collected.
That's good. Were the other people in the group able to handle it, too?
Oh, yes. Fred, Cash, Samuel Gooden, they were true brothers, and they still are. I mean, even to this day, and I'm 50 years old, I dream of these fellas, our being in concert and all the things that we probably have done. And I love them like brothers, maybe closer.
You said before that singing in the gospel group helped you understand harmonies and that you use some of those harmonies with the impressions. Let me play a record that I just particularly love the harmonies on. And this is I'm So Proud. It's really such a beautiful ballad. How would you work out the harmonies for one of the records? Maybe you could talk specifically about working out the harmonies on this one.
Well, a song like I'm So Proud, it just, there was nothing to work out. As soon as I would say prettier than all the world, through my melody would automatically come the harmonies of Fred and Sam. There was nothing to work out. It was easy as apple pie.
Let's hear I'm So Proud.
Prettier than all the world, and I'm so proud,
I'm so proud,
I'm so proud of you. You're only one fellow's girl, and I'm so proud,
I'm so proud,
I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of being loved by you. And it would hurt to know if you ever were untrue. Sweeter than the taste of a cherry so sweet. I'm so proud, girl.
I'm so proud.
I'm so proud of you. Compliments to you from all the people we meet. Yes, and I'm so proud.
I'm so proud.
Believe me, I love you too. I'm so proud of being loved.
Curtis Mayfield is my guest. Let me skip ahead to Superfly, the songs that you wrote for the film of that name. It's really such a great score, you know, such a great set of songs. How did you get the assignment to write the songs for the movie?
Well, a gentleman by the name of Philip Bentley in New York came to the Lincoln Center where I was appearing. Between shows, I met him and Sig Shore, who was to become the producer. Philip wrote the screenplay, and they were very hot about, especially Philip, who was from 125th Street in New York City. He wanted me to write the music for Superfly.
Was Superfly the first time that you used the wah-wah guitar?
It probably was.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I didn't use the wah-wah, to be honest. One of my guitarists actually introduced the wah-wah to me, and he was actually the wah-wah player.
It's funny, you know, every action TV show ended up like using that sound afterwards.
Well, that was a quite popular gadget or instrument.
Let me ask you about one of the songs I particularly like from Superfly, and that's Freddy's Dead, which I think became one of the most popular songs from the movie. I mean, one of the really good things about it is that the way this song tells a whole story.
Well,
do you talk about writing
of my
that?
Lyrics in song, if you listen closely, will not only give you a lyrical balance, but also give you a visual balance. And I think that's probably what was appreciated through Freddy's Dead, is that you could also see it visually. And it spoke of a young man who was a decent guy overall, but was dealing with the wrong crowd, in with the wrong crowd, and his doings were of the lowest caliber, dealing with drugs, and his old lady wasn't helping him any either.
It is dead. that's what I said. Let the man rap a plan, said he'd send him home. But his hope was a rope, and he should have known. It's hard to understand. There was love in this man. I'm sure all would agree that his misery was this woman and things. Now Freddy's dead. That's what I said. Everybody's misused him, ripped him off and abused him. Another junkie plan, pushing dope for the man. A terrible blow, but that's how it goes. Freddy's on the corner now. If you wanna be a junkie, wow. Remember Freddy's dead. We're all built up with progress, but sometimes I must confess, we can deal with rockets and dreams, but reality, what does it mean? Ain't nothing said. Cause Freddy's dead.
The new record, People Get Ready, is a tribute to you by many artists, and I think the profits from the record are going to be used to help pay medical bills.
I'm sure it will. The monies are being accumulated, and they certainly are appreciated from all who has made tribute. And you're certainly right in with people of my such injuries. You probably wouldn't be surprised, but the bills and things that has to do with upkeep and care are tremendous.
You had health insurance when you had the accident, didn't you?
Luckily, I did. As a matter of fact, I got the health insurance about 6 months prior to the accident.
Wow. What inspired you to get it?
Well, I was looking for it all the time. I had always kept my family and myself insured, but there was a year or so that I just... I could not afford to pay the $7,000-$8,000 insurances that was required of me. And I sort of got lost in the shuffle, such as many people. And upon regaining myself financially, I was able, through Ichiban, the help of John Abbey, and of course the company and people I worked for, to... get health insurance, and right in the nick of time.
Curtis Mayfield, he spoke with us from his home in Georgia. The new tribute record is called People Get Ready, and it's on Shawnakie Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the latest intelligence threat to America, our allies. We talk with Peter Schweitzer about how our political allies are conducting economic espionage against American businesses, stealing trade secrets. Now the American intelligence community is debating whether we should start conducting economic espionage too. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Tribeca, the new dramatic series on Fox, which is set and filmed in New York City. Robert De Niro is one of the producers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to a top UN mediator, Bosnian Serbs have pulled out of the current round of peace talks on Bosnia. David Owen says at issue is a UN plan to divide Bosnia into 10 separate provinces. Owen said at UN headquarters in New York that this is the end of this period of talks, and he's afraid they will go off now and fight. Owen and Cyrus Vance have been trying for half a year to get the various warring factions to agree to a UN peace plan and move the talks from Geneva to New York last month, hoping that the UN Security Council would apply pressure. President Clinton held his first full-fledged news conference this afternoon at the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The topic that dominated the 40-minute question-and-answer session with reporters was Russia. President Clinton repeated his support for both Russian President Boris Yeltsin and for the reform process that Yeltsin personifies. The president refused to speculate about what would happen to an American aid package if Yeltsin was impeached by the Russian parliament, and he said at this time he had no reason to be concerned that command and control procedures governing Russian nuclear weapons had been interrupted. The president was asked whether he would consider moving the site of the summit to Moscow if it was determined that it would be safer for Boris Yeltsin to remain in his own country. The president repeated the assurance that Foreign Minister Kozarev had given earlier in the day. As of now, there are no plans to change the date or time of the summit meeting. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A court in Moscow has ruled that President Boris Yeltsin was acting unlawfully when he declared emergency rule. The court ruling is non-binding and did not mention impeachment. However, hardline opponents see the ruling as grounds to remove Yeltsin from office. The Senate is debating a budget resolution that would cut more than $500 billion from the deficit. President Clinton has urged lawmakers to approve his plan in its entirety. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
During his news conference today, the president said his economic plan will work best as a package and called on Congress to approve each of its parts, including the stimulus plan and the budget resolution. The resolution is being debated in the Senate today, where a series of amendments is under consideration. One that passed, sponsored by Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn, stipulates that any further cuts from defense spending be used on deficit reduction rather than for spending on other domestic programs. Tennessee Democrat James Sasser said that was a bad idea.
There is no need to hold defense spending sacrosanct over other discretionary spending of the Congress.
Later tonight, the Senate will consider a Republican attempt to reduce the president's increase in Social Security taxes. Final vote on the plan is expected late tomorrow. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 1.5 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno has asked for the resignations of all holdover U.S. attorneys. Reno says the move is usual when there is a change in administrations. She also says that she will try and get legislation to give federal agencies a larger role in protecting abortion rights. Reno told a news conference that the government is now limited by a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that officials may not use federal civil rights law against protesters who block clinics. Officials in Central Florida are investigating the deaths of two Major League Baseball players who were returning from a fishing trip last night when their boat slammed into a dock. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Cleveland Indians pitcher Steve Olin was killed instantly. His teammate Tim Cruz died early this morning at a nearby hospital. A third passenger in the fishing boat was Cleveland's Bob Ojeda, who is listed in stable condition. Doctors say Ojeda should recover from his injuries. Investigators from the State Game and Freshwater Fish Commission say alcohol was found aboard the boat, but won't say yet if it had contributed to the accident. The Indians are in Central Florida for spring training. The team has canceled all of its exhibition games until Thursday. The Indians will hold a memorial service for Cruz and Olin tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Orlando.
In Bosnia, UN officials say that helicopters will start carrying people who were wounded out of eastern parts of the country sometime tomorrow. This air operation involving French and British helicopters will test a Serbian promise to open up an escape path for thousands of Muslims now under siege by advancing Serbian forces. At the same time, three UN convoys trying to get food to both eastern Bosnia and Sarajevo are still blocked by Serbian forces. Airlifts into the capital have been suspended for 4 days. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some of our allies are spying on us. They're not looking for our government secrets. What they want is the secrets of American business, science, and technology. Now, one of the biggest controversies in the American intelligence community is whether we should conduct economic and technological espionage, too, in order to stay competitive. My guest Peter Schweitzer has written a new book about economic espionage. He's a consultant to NBC News. One of his espionage stories won an Overseas Press Club Award for investigative journalism. In 1987 and 88, he served as a member of Senator Robert Dole's Defense Study Group. His new book, Friendly Spies, investigates the espionage conducted by countries that are our political allies and economic competitors.
In many cases, those countries that are most active in this field tend to be our closest allies. We're talking about countries like France, Germany, Japan, South Korea, and Israel, for example. And these countries have very close military and political ties with the United States, and they don't want to put those at risk. On the other hand, at the same time, they are our fiercest economic competitors when it comes to world markets, and they have no problem with simply seeing economics and politics as two separate spheres. In one area, there's cooperation. In another area, there's competition. The United States, I think, tends to have a much more naive view of economic and political affairs. We tend to believe that because we are political allies, that means, by and large, that we will not have the fierce economic competition that we might have with other countries. So I think we're handicapped by this sort of mentality.
So what we're talking about is countries that use their government's espionage system to find out business secrets and pass them on to that country's business.
That's right. And some of the operations are very sophisticated. They're the sort of operations, intelligence operations, that we traditionally associate with the Soviet KGB. This means, for example, that the French DGSE will plant moles in U.S. companies. They will run bag operations against U.S. businessmen visiting Paris. They will eavesdrop on U.S. corporate communications. And so these are operations that can yield, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business information that can be enormously helpful in making companies very competitive.
During the Cold War, the CIA used a lot of its money and time to spy on the Soviet Union. Did the KGB practice economic espionage, and did the CIA practice economic espionage against the Soviet Union?
Well, the Soviets did engage in economic espionage. It was primarily to gain access to U.S. Technological secrets that could be applied to the Soviet armed forces. But they did always have an interest in U.S. technological information in a variety of ways. The United States has never really had a broad-based economic espionage program. There were instances during the Cold War where we would spy on the Russian aviation industry, for example, and if we came across technological information that could benefit U.S. national security, we would take that information and pass it to a U.S. defense contractor. That's sort of an unwritten part of Cold War espionage. But I think the real question that's developing now is whether the United States should redirect its intelligence apparatus and focus more on our competitors. Because after all, now that the Cold War is over, there is going to be some shift and change in what our intelligence assets ought to be focusing on.
There are laws in the United States that prohibit the CIA from passing on information to private industry. What are the laws that make that illegal?
Well, there are statutes specifically that guide the conduct of the CIA, which say that they cannot pass business information to U.S. corporations. There are also legal statutes involving U.S. government relations, antitrust laws, for example, that would make it very difficult for the CIA to give technological information to IBM, for example. I think there's going to be a big debate as to whether that should change. But I think that the more difficult problem goes beyond simply the statutes and codes that we have, and that's the whole attitude in U.S. business. I think our business culture is going to make it very, very difficult to make this sort of a program of sharing intelligence information to U.S. corporations possible, quite simply because most corporations are skeptical about the government and what the government can do to help them. And they also feel that if they're given that information, that there will be strings attached.
Well, most other countries, at least the other countries who are engaging in economic espionage, don't have regulations that prevent their country's intelligence system from passing on secrets to business.
That's right. In Japan and France, for example, it's just a given that the government is going to tend to favor some companies sometimes and other companies at different times. And I think that that is a reflection of their business culture. In the United States, we have this notion of a level playing field, that everybody should have the same opportunity and the same chance to sell their products. One shouldn't be favored over the government by the government over the other. And that's something that's very alien in countries like Japan, Germany, and France. In those systems, it's basically what you can get from the government you're entitled to get, and you work very hard at doing it. And as we've seen in recent scandals, for example, in Japan, influence peddling in that country at least goes much deeper than it does in the United States. And so I think this is really the most difficult part for the United States in facing this whole problem. I personally don't think that imitating our allies by engaging in economic espionage is the right answer. I think the solution in this area ought to come in the United States being much more firm in punishing our competitors who use these sorts of techniques to make their companies more competitive. I think, for example, if a foreign government or foreign corporation is caught spying, they ought to face perhaps limited trade sanctions or increased tariffs for a time, up to a certain point where they're paying an actual economic cost for what they're doing. Right now, this behavior is very, very low risk and high yield, and I think until that equation changes, it will only continue and grow.
James Woolsey, the new head of the CIA, at his confirmation hearings, he said that economic intelligence was the hottest current topic in intelligence policy. Do you know where he stands on this issue?
It seems that James Woolsey is open and receptive to the CIA moving in this direction. And I think that is in part a reflection of the fact that, number one, he was appointed by a president who is very, very concerned about economic competitiveness. But number two is a reflection of the fact that James Woolsey does not have that much background in the intelligence field itself. It's ironic. You would think that the CIA and CIA regulators would be very enthusiastic about moving into the area of economic espionage, but they really aren't. They, are very concerned about all sorts of problems that it will lead to, that, 10, 20 years from now they will face a lot of complaints of corruption or other problems that are associated with this sort of program. If you have the CIA collecting information that is very valuable, that can be very useful to several companies, there's going to be a lot of pressure on those companies to try to develop contacts, financial or otherwise, with people in the intelligence community. We've seen that in the past in every other aspect in which the government has something that it can offer business, whether that's contracts through housing and urban development or specific export grants from the Department of Commerce, that corruption usually follows. And I think in this area, that wouldn't be the exception. And I think a lot of CIA regulars are concerned about that because they see that this potentially could damage the agency, obviously, in the long run.
You interviewed one agent or former agent who said, I'll risk my life for my country, but I'm not willing to risk my life for some company. Was that a common point of view?
Yes, it was. Somebody that goes into the CIA, may go in for a variety of reasons. One of those that tends to be fairly strong is the sense of patriotism. They feel like they're going to risk their lives or they're going to engage in some unwholesome activities because they're serving their country. When you start to say, look, you may have to risk your life, or you may have to risk imprisonment overseas because we need to get a new engine design to make General Motors more competitive, it's going to be you're going to have a very difficult time motivating somebody to be very effective or efficient. And you're also going to have a difficult time recruiting people to go into the CIA for that very reason. It just doesn't have the same attractiveness that you know, national security and national interest has.
You say that business is reluctant to have the CIA spy on its behalf, and that business is afraid that there would be strings attached. Can you elaborate on what the concerns are?
Yes. In 1986, then CIA Director Bill Casey started a program in which he tried to encourage U.S. corporations to allow the agency to use them as a conduit to collect information overseas. And he wasn't very successful in that because corporations obviously realized that if this scheme were uncovered, they would be seen as extensions of the CIA. I think the concern of most corporations is if the agency moves in this direction, that they will probably increase the pressure on companies to, you know, be used as conduits for information. But I think, second of all, there's a concern that most corporations have that de facto they would be seen as extensions of the CIA overseas. And that may not cause as many problems in a place like Canada or a place like Great Britain, but it could cause enormous problems in the Third World.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Schweitzer, author of the new book, Friendly Spies, How America's Allies Are Using Economic Espionage to Steal Our Secrets. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about economic espionage. My guest, Peter Schweitzer, is the author of the new book, Friendly Spies. Well, in America so far, our intelligence agency, the CIA, has decided not to engage in economic espionage and share the secrets with private enterprise. But meanwhile, it looks like private industry, that's some companies are developing their own intelligence arms.
That's right. As former CIA Director William Colby told me in an interview, intelligence is being privatized. Because technology is moving so quickly, the sort of technological devices that the CIA was using 20 years ago are now generally available in most electronic stores. With a little modification, a company can use the sorts of complex spy devices that the CIA was using a while ago and can use them very effectively. And I think corporations are also very tempted to move into the spy business simply because information in terms of making business decisions, in terms of making long-term corporate decisions, is becoming much more important. And so you have, in a lot of instances, U.S. corporations that are hiring numerous former intelligence officials. Motorola, for example, has established a intelligence organization that is remarkable in its resemblance to the CIA's National Intelligence Council. And, of course, that resemblance has a large part to do with the fact that it was organized by a former deputy director of the National Intelligence Council. And there are other corporations in the United States that are doing the very same thing.
Do American businessmen abroad get spied on? Do their phone conversations get bugged?
Yes, they do. And in many cases, it's the official telephone companies of the countries in question that are used. In the case of Japan, for example, Nippon Telephone and Telegraph is regularly used to monitor U.S. transoceanic corporate communications. That means that if a businessman working for a major U.S. corporation travels to Tokyo, chances are if the American employee is in Japan for a very sensitive purpose, that their phone conversations will be monitored. There's also the additional problem that there's widespread bugging in many Japanese hotels. And their hope is, of course, to get casual conversation or a serious conversation on the phone with somebody or with a business associate that can potentially be very helpful either at the trade table or at the business table.
Do you think that American businessmen abroad have changed their behavior because they're worried about getting bugged?
They have somewhat. In the case of Boeing, for example, and Hewlett-Packard, I know that when their businessmen go overseas now, they do not fax anything back to the United States. The Japanese have perfected a new espionage capability called faxpionage, and that means that if I'm in Tokyo and I fax something to you in the United States, they can very easily peel off and get a copy of the fax at a third location. Both of these companies have now decided, rather than faxing information or even talking on the phone, to simply use Federal Express to send any sensitive documents by overseas courier, because that way the chances of it being intercepted or copies being made is dramatically reduced. Other businessmen traveling overseas to locales like Paris, for example, have also taken to not leaving their hotel room and leaving business documents behind, because bag operations by French intelligence are very common and very sensitive and difficult to deal with.
Do you think in the near future the United States is going to be forced to either join those countries who are spying on businesses, or that the United States will be forced to punish allies who are spying on American businesses, but that it won't be able to afford to do nothing?
Yes, I think it will. I think we're moving in that direction already. You know, bureaucracies move very slowly. Bureaucratic inertia is something that probably takes 2 or 3 years to work its way out. And I think that the Cold War has been over for several years now, and I think that official Washington is finally realizing that this is a problem that has to be dealt with, that the Cold War is over. There's no longer the excuse of maintaining Allied solidarity at all cost, and therefore that this problem has to be addressed. I think the real question, the real fork in the road, is going to be whether we go down the route of imitating our competitors or whether we decide that we're going to make a very strong and public stand against this sort of activity. And I think that will largely be determined by who's making the decision and which institutions of government have the ear of the president.
Peter Schweitzer, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Schweitzer is the author of Friendly Spies. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton held his first White House press conference today. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, how are you covering that for All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report on that news conference talking about all the issues raised by Mr. Clinton and the reporters. Bill Clinton did reiterate his support for Boris Yeltsin as the democratically elected president of Russia. The Constitutional Court in Moscow has delivered a decision. Mr. Yeltsin's announcement that he is ruling by decree is indeed unconstitutional. I'll talk with Tom Jelton in Belgrade, who's been down in eastern Bosnia. He explains the village of Srebrenica there, full of refugees and starving people, seems to be about to fall to the Serb forces. Also, Bob Garfield reports on the problem of what to call female athletic teams in a town in Iowa.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Robert De Niro named his production company after the neighborhood in Lower Manhattan it's located in, Tribeca, which is also where he opened his restaurant. Now he's an executive producer of a new TV series called Tribeca, which premieres tonight on Fox. TV critic David Bianculli says it's an unusual project in at least three respects. It's set and filmed downtown in New York, it's an anthology drama series, and De Niro's involved.
Robert De Niro is the name that's going to bring most of the viewers to Tribeca. But he's not on the screen, and he's not the most active behind-the-scenes participant. That would be David J. Burke, the creator of the Tribeca series. It doesn't matter. What matters is getting people to sample Tribeca, because it's something very different and very satisfying. Burke's previous credits include Crime Story and Wise Guy, two good and gritty TV series that loved to present and develop unusual characters. In Wise Guy, the best roles went to the guest villains, who could come on, show off, and offer plenty of surprises. Since they weren't series regulars, their characters could do almost anything, even die. That same sensibility is what makes Tribeca so intriguing. Its focus is the neighborhood, the place, as well as the people there. The only continuing characters are a restaurant owner, played by Philip Bosco, and a mounted policeman, played by Joe Morton. Otherwise, all of the roles and most of the scenes go to guest stars, like Larry Fishburne and Carl Lumley, who play brothers in tonight's premiere episode. Fishburne plays Marty, a cop who's always coming up with get-rich-quick schemes. And Lumley plays Ernest, an investment banker who already is rich. When Marty comes to Ernest with an idea for an automated dry-cleaning service, he wants money, but gets a lecture.
Successful black men have an obligation to instill in the next generation the desire and ability to achieve success. And I don't see you doing that. Now, what I see is a successful black man who goes off duty and treats a good idea with the same casual abandon he treats women. But business is business. If you'd prepare yourself for it, I'd get you your money.
Why is this conversation turning into a prayer meeting for the Black Conservative Political Caucus, Ernest?
I want you to consider your greater responsibilities.
A white man goes to his rich brother and says, I need help. He does not say to him, no, we have to see how your behavior affects the rest of our people. He doesn't do that.
He doesn't have to.
In next week's episode, Stephen Lang guest stars as a homeless man. Morton, in his recurring role as the cop, tries to run him out of the park for the holiday weekend, but Lang resists.
I'm the state. We are the state. This is a public place. I'm not leaving.
Don't create a problem.
You're creating a problem.
Everybody has to leave.
So who are you, huh? Uncle Fascist.
Now, you can leave on your own steam, or me and my fascist friends can escort you out at the ends of our batons. Your choice, you make it.
You look at me, huh? You think you can hurt me? I work out here in the elements. I empower you. I'm the state. You hurt me and you hurt yourself.
The writing, acting, and directing all help Tribeca stand out. But though Tribeca is good and different enough to seem new, it really isn't. In fact, it's more of a giant step backwards. It's the first show to use New York City locations this effectively since East Side, West Side with George C. Scott and Cicely Tyson. And as an anthology drama series in primetime, it's the most ambitious project since The Richard Boone Show, which featured regular performers in different roles each week. Actors like Boone, Robert Blake, and Harry Morgan. Both of those series, incidentally, came and went in one season 30 years ago. Finally, the concept of having a few regular characters in an anthology series in order to help build audience loyalty is a trick that was used to keep a lot of TV shows afloat, from drama shows hosted by Alfred Hitchcock and Rod Serling to escapist fantasies like The Love Boat and Fantasy Island. Tribeca, though, is no fantasy island. It's Reality City.
David Bianculli is still television critic for the New York Post. He's also the author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Sue Weinstein, with Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last week, the UN released a report on human rights abuses by the military in El Salvador. Recently declassified documents show that the Reagan administration withheld information about human rights abuses there. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Thomas Blanton of the National Security Archives, the group that gained access to the documents. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.